Someone mind helping me with the table here? That's an ideal segue, really, Marshall, into what I wanted to explore a little bit this morning. As mentioned, David first and then Mark Budenberg, who incidentally is away for a couple of months in England, so keep him in your prayers, and then Lee a couple of weeks ago. They each had a text which was a moment in scriptural history where God interrupted their life or opened their eyes to this other reality where there is stuff going on that isn't immediately apparent. The first one was Abraham, who just was really struggling at his age and stage to believe God's promise that he would be a father of many nations, of many descendants. And God invites him to get out of his tent and count the stars, try and count the stars. And there's something in that exchange when Abraham believes. There's something in that moment where he says, well, okay, if you made all of that, why am I suddenly thinking that you can't give me a child? And it changed him. And then there's the story of Elisha and his servant. Elisha's in a city surrounded by the enemy, and his servant's terrified because they're going to be killed. And Elisha prays, Lord, open my servant's eyes. And all of a sudden, there's this army of fiery angels surrounding this pitiful little human army by comparison. And in that revelation, it's all okay. It's all changed in a moment. And then there's what Lee looked at a couple of weeks ago, the conversion of Paul, a godly man who was incensed at this cult that Jesus had started that was ruining the faith of Israel and was determined to stamp it out. And on his way to find Christians and probably, certainly in prison, probably kill, he is struck by a bright light, knocked off his donkey, blinded, and in that voice, in this light, is the voice of the Lord, voice of Jesus, saying, why are you contending against me? And his life is entirely changed. So we've been looking at world views, the way we see the world, what we think is our best understanding of what is real. And that, and there are two ways that your worldview gets changed. One is something like these stories where you have a particular perspective. You are sure that you're sure that you're sure that Abraham can't have a child at 90 or 100. That you're sure that these human armies are going to destroy you. You're sure that this church under Jesus is a cult. And then an outer revelation comes. And I mean, revelation is a shocking and rupturing and disrupting experience. It totally tears your world apart. It doesn't just change some of your behaviors. It doesn't just change some of your beliefs. It totally reorients your life. It tears it apart and says, what you thought was really, really real isn't as real as you thought. There are deeper realities at work. There's another way you can do this, though. And it's what I think of, and I'm borrowing from others who know better than me, way that you can change your worldview. It's what you'd call genuine conversion or deep conversion. You could convert at a shallow level and only change a few behaviors. Maybe you start going to church, for instance. Maybe you change deeper than that and you begin to get a better understanding. Your beliefs start to shift around who is God and who am I and those kinds of things. But underneath all of that is this deeper rooted belief system that when push comes to shove, you fall back to that. And it's that that needs to change. And if it's not an outer revelation that tears your world apart, it can be done just via reflection, by examination. The trouble with worldviews, these assumptions, is when you assume you know what's real, you don't realize that you're assuming it. Right? By assumption, they exist and they create all these other beliefs that come out of that. So take, for instance, the only way you should travel on the road, right? There should be very clear rules. We need to know that you drive on the left, that when there is a red stoplight, you stop, and when it's green, you go, that there are certain etiquette, actually law, about how you go around roundabouts, what kind of, will you give away to the right, all of those kinds of things, right? Total rules. Go to India and try that. They don't operate by those rules. They operate entirely by negotiation. I'm coming, make way. And how do they do that? On their tukis or whatever they're called, and I can't remember what they're called in India. Tuk-tuks. They drive by relationship. I'm in your space, you either make room or we collide. Honestly, you wouldn't want to drive there. It would do your head in. It would take you a long time to orient. You don't wait for someone to give you space. They won't. You get in there, you negotiate, you bargain, you barge. There are no stoplights, or if there are, no one's watching them. They don't care. Two different realities. Two different ways of looking at the world. Two different fundamental attitudes toward how society could be. What is right? Is it right that we have to have the rules that we have for our road rules? Is that necessary? Is it absolutely the truth? And if God comes to earth, he's going to establish those road rules everywhere and go to India and go, "You guys, you've got it wrong." Or is it that actually there's lots of ways of doing some things? And we need to examine our underpinning worldviews. Sit back and go, okay, so some people see things differently here, like really differently. That gives me a chance to reflect on, what am I seeing? Why do I act this way? This, by the way, I'll say it now because I may not make the connection later, but because this is a bit of a ramble, a bit of an exploration. What I'm thinking about here is how I'm connecting this to Waitangi is it's, I think, quite typical, particularly among white New Zealanders, to look at Waitangi as this is just going to cost us exercise. We are afraid, I think, that the Waitangi Treaty and the process to create a bit more justice based on what was done in the past, stealing land from Māori, that's just going to be a cost and it's just going to be painful and we're in the losing situation at fixing this, right? I think that it's quite easy to get that attitude, and certainly if you looked at the news, all you would see is conflict. But the news is, again, by the way, it's just a worldview. It's a lens on a very small part of reality. It's not the full reality. If you went to Waitangi, I understand, it's a celebration. People are enjoying themselves. The moments of conflict are tiny, and they're narrowed on and focused on because news media, I was in news media. If it bleeds, it leads. You only look for conflict. You don't look at all the great stuff going on. You only look for conflict. So we get a skewed view of the Waitangi celebration. But I've become kind of convicted that actually I think we have far more to gain from this than we have to lose. That yes, there will be some cost as a nation fixing some of those historical errors, but actually I think we're far better off. In the same way that I'm far better off with my wife, though in negotiating all things in life, there is, right, it takes energy, it takes time, I can't just make decisions about how I'm going to spend my money. It's now our money. Am I losing in that sense? Or have I gained something more by being married to Rebecca? They reckon at the moment that if you were to calculate the cost of raising a child from birth to 18, it's around about $230,000. Thinking that the Waitangi Tribunal and a bicultural relationship is a cost and only worse for us than better, is it like thinking that having a child because it's going to cost you $236,000 is only a cost, right? I have never sat down and tried to calculate out what it costs us to raise our children, and I suspect I never will because the benefit of having children far outweighs the cost. So I have that attitude, and it's a growing conviction. I have that attitude around our relationship to Māori and what they can bring to our relationship, what they can bring to us, particularly to the church. Because they see the world very differently than a classic, modern, enlightened, white person who sees the world in terms of laws and structure, and they see the world in terms of relationship, negotiation, harmony. And as Marshall has so very aptly pointed out, the Christian faith is entirely relationship based. You are only saved by the notion that you are a child of God, not by some transaction, not because someone paid a debt that you were paid. We use that language, but ultimately it comes down to a relationship of someone wanting to rescue a loved one from a horrible situation, no matter the cost. But what we find very hard in our Christian thinking as white people is we constantly come to our faith as a transactional thing. Oh, I've done something wrong. I've sinned. I better make it right. I better go to church or give more, or I better read the Bible more. Or if I'm going to establish a deeper relationship, there's probably some things I have to do to make sure that God still likes me. But again, as Marshall said, we don't measure our family and our children in those same ways. If I said to Oliver, our youngest, buddy, your dishwashing standards are not up to scratch. You know, he's three plates with bits left on them. That pan still feels oily. You're not doing your job. And I tell you what, I have it on good report that little Johnny down the road is doing his dishes really well. You're on thin ice here, buddy. If you don't come up to scratch, I'm going to swap you for little Johnny. Because it's all about the task, right? This is about you getting those dishes done right. And if you don't get them done right, you're out. Transactional, task-focused. It's about what you do. It's about fulfilling laws and doing the right things instead of, but Dad, I'm your son. Who's little Johnny? Right? I'm not going to kick Oliver out because his dishwashing skills are below par. It's up to me to do what I can, probably to wash them for him, but to teach him how to do it, right? That's what the family business looks like. So I'm connecting these thoughts, this idea of I have a particular worldview, and I think I need a better, wider, deeper one, and I think Māori have something helpful for us. They have a wealth of way of seeing the world that I need. It came home to me a little bit as well, and thinking how this affects us all. There's a Netflix documentary called 7 Days Out or something like that. It's about five different world events and the 7 days leading up to that event. One of them was the deep space satellite called the Cassini. It's been a 20-year project orbiting Saturn and its moon, its planets, and trying to get data so we can understand the universe that we're in, or at least the solar system we're in. And its fuel cells were running down, and because obviously they're all about conservation, they didn't want this to be a bit of space junk, so they were going to plunge it into Saturn's atmosphere and it would burn up. So that was the 7-day build-up to the end of a 20-year project of, you know, incredible data, amazing photos, all sorts of stuff. What struck me in this documentary was a young researcher, a young lady who put, I think, words to what everyone in that project was feeling. And again, 20 years, a lot of these people have devoted so much of their life, not just to career, but this is a life to this project. And she gushed about, you know, we have, through these kinds of projects, I go to work every day just so excited. Every time I go to work and pull into the car park and realize what I'm doing, I'm so excited. I'm thrilled to be part of this because we're bringing hope to humanity. How? Because they've discovered that there might be some water on one of the moons around Saturn. So, potential for life on a moon around Saturn. Are you filling with hope yet? Because she is. She's filling with hope. Why? Because her assumption, and many people's assumptions, is that this planet is a machine quickly running out of energy. That we're fouling it up, partly. That we're overpopulating it and it's going to run out of resource, partly. And when it gets to the tipping point, we better hope we've got somewhere to go to continue the human species. So her hope, and I tell you what, I reckon this is the best address in the solar system, probably in the galaxy, maybe in the universe, and I'm not that excited about going to a moon around Saturn, which looked jolly cold. Even if there's a bit of water there. There's a lot of water here, by the way. I don't know if she realized that. But you see, and listening to that and thinking, she is so excited about going to work. Why am I not? Like, don't forget me wrong, I enjoy my job. But she had a fizz and a joy. The whole group did. They were pumped on this thing. And I'm pretty convinced that the hope of humanity isn't a moon around Saturn or even going anywhere else. I don't hope in science to fix the deepest problems that we face. I think that science has done some wonderful things and given us amazing treasures, but I think that we're beginning to trust it a little too much. And so I thought, why? I think I'm part of the Real Hope Project. I think that somehow all things hold together in this man called Jesus. Like, all things, including Earth, which even if it is struggling, it's still being held together by him. And if that's true, and if he has promised that he will bring a new heaven and a new earth, then I don't need to worry about somewhere else for my future. I don't need to worry about some awful little Mars base or some tiny little below this rock hole on a moon around Saturn. But she's excited about that. Why am I not excited about what I'm doing? Are we excited about it? And I realized that this worldview thing, I mean, I grew up in the worldview of science and of seeing reality a certain way, and that it's easy to hold beliefs about God at a cognitive level to know that God is Father, right? We know that. Marshall told us nothing new, right? If he told you something new, fantastic. If he didn't, but Marshall wasn't trying to preach to the point where you understand. He was trying to preach to the point where you know. And that's the worldview point. That's the, I know we have hope. Jesus is hope. He has fixed everything and is fixing everything and will fix everything. But why do we find it so hard to feel that as hope? Why do we find it so hard to enjoy that, deeply enjoy that? Because we live in this culture, right? And its influence on us is like slow-release poison or like an acid dripping and just etching away at the surface of our belief. So we need to get it deeper. We need to get it down to worldview. Just some fun stuff. Just to demonstrate again, different worldviews, different ways of seeing reality. I hope this pen works. I do have another one. Oh, no, it doesn't work. I think these are good. Right. There we go. You didn't realize you were coming to an art exhibition. Oops. Oh, burn. All right, four figures. Now, if you already have seen this diagram, please don't spike the ball for everyone else. Which of these four doesn't belong? Okay, sorry? The little one, okay. The little one? Hands up if you think it's the little one. Why do you think it's the little one? By the way, there's no wrong answer. I have to be, and I'm not even just playing. There's no wrong or right answer to this. This is about different ways we see reality. Okay. So the little one, because why? It's not uniform. We've got three big people and one little person. So the one that doesn't fit is the little person. Any other views? Rick? The one on the end. Why the one on the end? You've seen this, haven't you? Oh, you haven't. Yeah, so another way of looking at this is dad, mum, child. So this one's probably an uncle. So it doesn't belong. Or an auntie, maybe. Right? So that's another way of looking at it. So one categorizes as far as the intrinsic similarities, meaning what they have in common in themselves. So the three common elements of an intrinsic set would be the tallest, the big people, because they have the most in common. But an extrinsic set would say, hang on a minute, this is about relationships to things. And we know that a set of dad and mum and child is natural, and you don't have a third adult in that, it's probably a relation. And so it doesn't fit most naturally in that set. So it's a relational set. So thinking of it this way, I know Alex, I know that he is he owns a company in IT, is a bit of a train geek, train model trains. I hope I'm not outing you on this case. I mean, I'm sure they'll still love you after this. He serves at on the sound desk. He's got some sound desk capability. He's a male. He wears glasses. He's about 5'8". Those are intrinsic. Whatever. Those are intrinsic qualities. Those are things about Alex the person, his qualities, the things that he can do. All right. If I were to describe Alex extrinsically in his relationship set, I would say, I know Alex because he is husband to Judy. I know Alex because he is father to Ella and Brad and Joel. I know Alex because he served as an elder on Chapel Hill and he is a member of Chapel Hill Community Church. I know Alex, where he's born, I know Alex. So you're talking about Alex as far as how he relates to others. So those are two different ways of seeing reality. And another one. This might stretch my drawing capabilities a bit more. So far, so good. And all right. Do you know what those are? A hammer, a saw, a piece of wood, an axe. Okay, so of those four objects, which one doesn't belong? The piece of wood? Anyone else? The hammer. Why the piece of wood?
They're all tools.
They're all tools? Piece of wood is not? Great. Hammer because? Doesn't cut the timber. Okay. So, one way is going, well, the intrinsic qualities of the tools, the hammer, the saw, and the axe, means that they belong to a set, right? Scientific worldview, totally valuable. The relational worldview, the extrinsic one is, well, what's the point in any of these tools without a piece of wood? And the ones that are most related would be possibly, and you can change your views on this, is the saw can cut the wood down and the axe will split it for firewood. Or you could say, actually, axe and saw, oh, they do a similar job. Let's ditch one of those two and we'll have a hammer. But we need the wood because without the wood, what's the point, right? So it's about where does value come from? Where do we derive value? Is it from, does Alex derive value? Do we value him because of what he can do for us? Is it his task ability, his skill set? Or do we value Alex because he's one of ours? He's part of our family. And he's one of God's. So it's not wrong to look at Alex and know what skills he has. Every worldview uses different sets of logic, all of the sets of logic, but some worldviews preference others more than one.
I've got it that the wood is the victim, the other has
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So we have a worldview, Western enlightened. What an interesting use of word, isn't it? Because enlightened used to mean that you had a spiritual enlightenment. I think enlightenment was used to say we've woken up from our hocus-pocus, superstitious world, and we see reality as it really is now. It's just material. There's nothing behind there. I think that's what enlightenment came to mean, the opposite of what it actually meant initially, the opposite of what it meant to Paul when his eyes were suddenly, or what it meant to the servant of Elisha when he suddenly saw, right? Because we live in a world that so rapidly and readily evaluates all things according to a particular value set, the intrinsic, how are they alike, as opposed to a worldview that says, well, how am I related to? So in a worldview where you're related to things, you're related to God, the Father, who created all of this world. This is his creation, his beloved thing. And we are part of it. We are related to this creation. We don't get to just walk off the planet and leave it all behind. Isn't it say in Scripture that I was made of dust and then God breathed a spirit in me? I'm part of this planet. I'm related to it. In that worldview, the hope is, well, I hope that the Father is good enough and strong enough to fix all of these things. In a worldview of a mechanized, well, we're humans, we're not part of the rest of the set. We can go anywhere. We can cut our ties with this machine, this world that is useful, but when it runs out of usefulness, we'll go, then your hope has to be in science, has to be in that worldview. And we live in that other one, don't we? We live in that dual world, how we're trying to bring these things together. Need to land the plane a little bit, don't I? Running out of time. Perhaps I'll just conclude it there. You don't know what you don't know, which is why we have other people who come alongside and help us see different realities, help us explore things, help us examine our assumptions. People who come along and go, oh, I didn't see it that way at all. You go, oh, hey, is there another way of seeing it? I didn't recognize that. And then you begin to talk. And I think that the relationship we could have with Māori would be of nothing but great benefit to us. That I think that they are more in tune by habit, by relational connection, by seeing the world as far as relationships and connections, that they have more to offer us perhaps than we have to offer them. That their connection to seeing things in relationship is so much more fitting with a scriptural worldview that we would benefit greatly from what they have to share with us.
Is that why land can, in a sense, be owned?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. You're talking about, I mean, so much of what happened was two worldviews that simply could not communicate simply together, assuming that there was only one way to see reality and that they both held it. And when someone says, I'm going to buy this land, and the other party says, I don't know what you mean by that. If what you mean is make use of or have some access to it, yeah, sure, I'll take your muskets and blankets. Yeah, so these two diagrams and there's others came out of a study looking at lots of different cultures and worldviews, all about worldview and how you see things, and almost all older, ancient, traditional societies would see those diagrams in a relational context. Ours, our European enlightened heritage, wherever you get a nation that thinks scientifically, we would see the intrinsic value in things. But every other, and of course the one that we came from before the Enlightenment saw the world that way too. It's taken us about 500 years to break our connection to our earth, to ourselves, to one another, and to our God. But we've done a really good job of it, and now it's really hard to get that back. Yeah. Any observations before we wrap up? We see the world as we are. That is. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
relational world, though. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, it's scientific now since Renaissance or whatever, but, you know.
Mm. Yeah, Christianity is an Eastern religion. Mm. It's not a Western one. It's not a religion of science. Which isn't to say, and we should never pit science and religion against each other, because that's not at all what I'm saying. I think it's quite fun to go send things out just to look at Saturn, but not to find hope, not to find reason for living or hope for life, but to explore what God's made. It's very different.
So any religion brought into this scientific world is sort of alien to it, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what we've got is a new religion. We have an ideology, a belief system. If you want to go to a modern-day temple today, probably the best one you could go to would be a mall. Now, a university would be another one, hospital would be another one, or a science lab, but a mall is probably the one that you go to most, and it's entirely designed around similar principles of creating a new creation. So you go into there, and there are no windows. You can't look out to the world around you to wonder, oh, what time is it? Is it raining? It creates an entire enveloped world, a new creation. You enter into it. This is your temple. And you go along, and you look into these different shops, and you see the examples of this perfect new creation, these mannequins dressed up in the perfect sort of outfit. And it builds in you a yearning, at a heart level, to want to be like that and to look like that. Now, the temples, why? Because they are trying to get us to worship these things. And it's an eternal space, and it has its own music. The heavenly choir of, I don't know who, Boys to Men or whatever, quietly singing in the background to give you the impression that you've entered a new world, a new universe, and it's whatever you want it to be. Provided you've got enough money, you can recreate yourself. They're temples, absolutely. This frustrates me too when people talk about spiritual things and non-spiritual things. Wherever you go, it's a spiritual thing. Whatever you do, it's a spiritual thing. You go to the mall, it's a spiritual exercise. How you do that is going to affect you. What you think about what you're doing when you do that is affecting you. It's affecting me. And the worship, you know, the advertising is worship songs. Teaching us to think, how great is Aldi? How perfect in all its ways is Bunnings? Whatever. We're in a worshiping fight. We're in a battle for hearts and minds at a deep core worldview level. It's not just beliefs. You want to? Yeah, you go. Yeah, get me off the stage. I'm rambling on.